This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. If you were to think of one novel that sums up and embraces the sweep of American experience and identity, what would it be? Moby Dick, The Great Gatsby, or maybe Beloved by Toni Morrison? What's your choice for the great American novel?
The phrase "the great American novel" was first introduced in the 1860s by a now mostly forgotten writer from Connecticut named John W. DeForest. Back then, DeForest argued that the book had yet to be written. There were certainly great American novels, but the great American novel? Nope, not yet. Maybe not ever.
Over the years, writers and literary critics have debated what constitutes the great American novel. Many have tried to write it, many others to define it. Henry James made fun of the concept, and in fact, some dismissed the very idea as silly and meaningless. Given the vastness and diversity of America, is it even possible or worthwhile to talk about the great American novel?
Whatever the answer, the phrase is full of meaning, and it is still with us, as Lawrence Buell reminds us in his new book, The Dream of the Great American Novel.
Lawrence Buell is a professor emeritus of American literature at Harvard University, and he joins us now. And Lawrence Buell, welcome to the program. Great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
This is a really fun and provocative set of ideas that you've put in here. And I want to sort of invite listeners in right away before I start talking to you. Listeners, we're talking to Lawrence Buell. He's written this great book called The Dream of the Great American Novel. What do you think defines the great American novel? Do you think there is one great American novel? And if so, what's your pick? Or what's your question for Professor Lawrence Buell? Give us a call at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We're also at Twitter and Facebook at Radio Boston. Larry, I want to ask you a little bit about what inspired you to write this, because right at the beginning, you write, when I started planning this book some years ago, I had in mind a brisk, short narrative of the rise and fall of an amusing example of a national brag, now long since obsolete and never accounting to much more than a parlor game. But 460, 70, 80 pages later, obviously you rethought that idea.
I did, yes. When I was in grad school, I was taught this was a short-lived obsession that disappeared in the late 1800s, and I discovered that was not so. Hmm. And that it seemed unkillable after its death had been pronounced many times. As Mark Twain said of his own death, the rumors have been exaggerated, fascinated me that the talk, the dream is still going on. So here was a chapter of Americana, intriguing and I think telltale, that had never been told.
Mm. So why has it, you have part one of your book, it refers to the great American novel as the unkillable dream. Why has it persisted so long?
I think there are a variety of reasons, and no one explanation captures it all. One, for sure, is that the U.S. is always thought of itself as a country of the future, a project forever in the making. And that descends down to the realm of the arts as well. Mm. And no better example of that mentality exists than our fiction, this great American novel idea. I've got to say that the way it has percolated through the ages, it's like the history of the term United States in reverse. The term United States started as a plural until the Civil War, and since then it's been a singular noun. The great American novel is used as a singular, but really the idea is that it's a plural, that there are many paths, and any particular book is an approximation, and it's a horizon that we shoot for. We don't want to achieve it. What would we do for an encore?
Well, in fact, and obviously your book isn't sort of, you don't search for an answer to what is the great American novel, because there are many great American novels, and we're going to be sort of talking about a lot of the examples that you refer to. But I wonder if you could take us back to the 1860s, to this fellow from Connecticut named DeForest. And what John W. DeForest in 1868, give us some cultural context, where the nation was that sort of helped explain the emergence of this concept that he expressed.
There are two opposite conditions that I think are most important. On the one hand, there's a sense of huge relief and high expectation as the nation has come back together, and it's on the verge of a huge techno-economic and geographic takeoff. It's about to become the 19th century equivalent of China today. It becomes a techno-economic power, a world power, within a generation, and people can see that happening in the 1860s. On the other hand, there's this lingering anxiety about cultural underperformance. What do we have to show in the arts that can measure up to the great European cultures? A kind of lingering post-colonial anxiety. So those two conditions, I think, really create the synergy for this dream.
So to sort of pick up on the second part of that point, is this sort of a little bit of comes from almost a kind of sense of cultural insecurity in the mid-19th century that we should be establishing our own sort of literary tradition? So let's talk about what makes it a great literary tradition?
Yes, indeed. Today, we look at matters quite differently. Today, we realize that already Nathaniel Hawthorne, Herman Melville, Harriet Beecher Stowe, and others, Walt Whitman and poetry, they'd already done their best work in the late 1860s. But at that time, the intelligentsia just wasn't quite so confident. The situation was rather like the one other nation on earth that has anything like a great American novel tradition. That's Australia. Another post-colony. Mm-hmm. They have the same acronym, GAN, only it's a different country, of course. The conditions are much the same.
Well, let's talk about some specific books and sort of the way you divide this book up, because you talk about many great works of American literature, books that might be considered candidates to be the GAN or the GAN, and they fall into one of several scripts. So let's talk about these. The first is Made Classic by Retelling, and you offer as an example The Scarlet Letter by Nathaniel Hawthorne. So what sort of makes that a contender?
That it's been retold, its story, in different forms from generation to generation by writers of high talent. Not every single one of them American, by the way. George Eliot, the great Victorian novelist, had a go at it in her first major novel. Henry James, in a couple of his books, reran aspects of the Scarlet Letter plot. John Updike wrote not one but three books from the standpoint of three of the major characters in Scarlet Letter. Faulkner, one of his novels, is a kind of guarded, encrypted retelling of the Scarlet Letter plot. So it has this sort of cumulative momentum. And then you look at popular culture and you see, for example, the teen movie Easy A that came out within the last several years. The Scarlet Letter lives. Again, a Scarlet Letter is a familiar cliche anymore. The stigma that attaches not just to adultery, but to political turpitude, slung back and forth. So it's entered the bloodstream of popular culture.
Listeners, we're talking to Lawrence Buell of Harvard about his book, The Dream of the Great American Novel. You can join the conversation. What do you think defines the great American novel? Is it a concept that is important to talk about, to understand? Give us your thoughts at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Larry, let's take a call. We've already got some people backed up. I'd love to talk to you. Pat is calling from Dorchester. Hi, Pat. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks a lot. I guess I just have a comment. I want to see what Professor Buell thinks. The session's gone on so long, that's like the biggest characteristic of it. It seems to me like the length of the discussion and the fruitlessness of it is a bit of an American humble brag. The fact that we can't find an answer implies that we think that other cultures can be essentialized in one book like War and Peace or whatever culture you're talking about, and we can't be centralized in one book because of our bigness and our American diversity, et cetera. What do you think about that humble brag?
I think humble brag is just a terrific phrase. I wish that I'd talk with you before I'd finished the book. I would have somehow found a way to put it in. it prompts me to say about almost all of the probable suspects. I discuss 12 or 15 in the greatest detail. You don't find any of them almost being patriotic or tub-thumping about the great American nation or the great American project. On the contrary, what they're mostly about is calling attention to the gap between the promises of the nation, of the Declaration, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and the actual realization, the under-delivery of what we have. The first of the serious candidates proposed, Uncle Tom's Cabin by Harriet Beecher Stowe, that was a very divisive book in its denunciation of slavery, and some say it even helped to catalyze the Civil War. But out there in the cheering section, those who are calling for the great American novel to appear, a humble brag, that may be a pretty good characterization of that talk, too.
Well, Larry, this sort of picks up on one of the things Pat was alluding to there. And as you know, this idea of the great American novel has been poo-pooed by some critics and scholars over the years who say, and Pat sort of brought up this point, that this country is just too big, too diverse, too large. There's just too much going on to even think that one novel could come close to sort of encapsulating what it's about.
Well, if you take my point from before, that really what's being talked about is an approximation, mm-hmm. a plurality, then I think it makes more sense that the bigness and the heterogeneity are provocations or inspirations for the novelist to go on and try to come just a little bit closer to nailing it,
sure.
to capturing it.
Well, let me talk about a sort of a second script that you talk about, and that is the rags to riches sort of script that defines some of these books as uniquely American. Great example of that, which, you know, if you were going to ask me what would be on my list for the great American novel, would be The Great Gatsby by F. Scott Fitzgerald, right? So this is one of these classic American rags to riches stories.
You bet. Thing to add here, two things. One is that books of that kind that make it to the top of the heap quarrel with that old Ben Franklin stereotype. What they say through a figure like Gatsby is, oh yeah, Fitzgerald turns his hero into a tragic figure at last. The other thing important to say has to do with the updating of the scripts or recipes, to use a more homely word. During the 20th century, one of the really striking stories about that script is that it becomes multi-ethnic. By the mid-20th century, you're seeing books like Invisible Man becoming more the defining examples of that kind of novel.
Hmm. Another script that you talk about is, you call it Romancing the Divides, and a family saga that grapples with racial and other social divisions, black versus white, rich versus poor, east versus west. Classic example of this, Uncle Tom's Cabin by Harriet Beecher Stowe.
Right. Here are the gazillions of books that I at least touch on at one point or another during my book. The bookends of the books are Uncle Tom's Cabin and Toni Morrison's Beloved. I concentrate on books that focus on black, white, north, south lines of division. That simplifies very, very greatly. We could think east, west. We could think across other racial or ethnic dividers. I did what I did, concentrating on North, South, Black, White, because it seems to me that that has been the single most dominant fictional concentration from the beginnings down through right now, when we're commemorating the 150th anniversary of the Civil War, and we're looking at the movie of the year, 12 Years a Slave, based on one of the great slave narratives, Solomon Northup's book of that title. And that's a romance of the divide, if there ever was one.
It's interesting. I want to ask you, sort of, while we're talking about Uncle Tom's Cabin, I learned in your book that when it first came out, it was torn apart by many critics, right? Because Harriet Beecher Stowe, she was sort of, for her unpolished writing style. So what keeps that in the GAN category?
I think what keeps it in the GAN category is that it's a lot better written than it was originally given credit for being. Harriet Beecher Stowe had a very strong dose of her ministerial father's post-Puritan scruples about being a fiction writer. It was only at this moment that novels were beginning to be accepted as a legitimate high art form. And in religious circles, the slowest to accept. So she tended to make the case in public for this being a work of fact rather than a work of fiction. So I think it took a while. It took quite a long while for the novelistic subtleties of the book to start to be realized. But another thing that Uncle Tom's Cabin raises, I think, that's very important about the whole great American novel arena, the talk and the practice, is that there's no firewall that can be drawn between high art and mass market. A book that's pitched transparently to the mass market and the mass market alone is not going to make a durable great American novel candidate. But on the other hand, an esoteric cerebral head trip is not going to make it either. Mm. At different points, Harriet Beecher Stowe, her novel has been a novel acclaimed by intelligentsia, and at other points, a novel that tear-jerked the mass market.
Let me throw two sort of ideas at you here, which come in from our listeners. Addie Barwise writes on Facebook, To Kill a Mockingbird. I guess she's saying that's her vote for the great American novel. Boston Radio Girl tweets, How about Grapes of Wrath? Where do those two books fall in the sort of pantheon of the great American novel?
Grapes of Wrath gets extensive treatment in a section about still another recipe that you haven't mentioned. That's the cross-section novel where we see a cohort of some kind, often a kind of ethnic microcosm, but in the case of Steinbeck, it's displaced Midwestern farmers forced into migrant labor in California. We see this cohort whose plight showcases democracy under duress at a critical moment in history. So Steinbeck's in there for sure. As for To Kill a Mockingbird, I like the book, but it turned out that it wound up getting a brief honorable mention rather than extensive treatment. And this is one of many, many examples of how even in 560 pages, you can't cover it all.
Mm. Does this dream of the great American novel, should it extinguish? If it were to extinguish one day, and we'll get to that because you write about that toward the end of the book. But would we lose something valuable? Has it contributed in some productive way to the development of the American literary tradition?
I think it's been an energizer. I think sometimes it's also been a trap. Some of the great American novel wannabes and probable suspects needed more of relentless editing than they got. They're a bit on the oversized size. I think that as Pat, the first listener, suggested, there's an element of brag that can get out of control in talk about great American novel.
Right.
Why should the Americans be any greater than the Russians or the French? And in fact, many would say our writers haven't been. But overall, it seems to me that given that the writers that go for the most ambitious projects have not been boosters, but they've been assessors, canny, often severely critical of the gap between the promise and the achievement in national history. They've collectively been the conscience of the public sphere in the area of fiction, and that's a precious resource.
Now, in your epilogue, you talk about the possibility of this idea of the dream of the great American novel going into permanent eclipse, possibly, because we move farther and farther away from the American century. Do you think that'll happen, or where do you see it going, as a final question?
Scholars like me are a lot better at hindsight than we are at prophecy. So I'm not sure. And in the epilogue, I'm cagey, bottom line. I give a set of arguments for expecting it might continue. I give a set of arguments for the possibility of sundown. One thing is for sure, though, if American stature in the eyes of the world and in its own diminishes, and we no longer become the diaspora of choice for many countries, that'll put great American novelism on the defensive.
All right. Well, that's Lawrence Buell. He's a professor emeritus of American literature at Harvard. His book is called The Dream of the Great American Novel. He'll be reading from it Thursday night. A lot more information at radioboston.org. Larry Buell, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Listeners, stay with us. There's more ahead. This is Radio Boston.